I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
This is hella exciting. We are sans Brian for this recording, and that's quite all right. But in Brian's place, we've got Dr. Anne Wagner, who is a clinical psychologist and treatment development researcher based in Toronto, Canada. And Anne is the founder of Remedy, which is a mental health innovation community, and the Remedy Institute, which is Remedy's home for research. And the reason I'm so excited for this conversation is because we are diving back into the world of the future and the use of psychedelics, in particular being used to treat things like mental disorders and beyond. And Anne, I know that this is a big part of your work, especially at the Remedy Center, the Remedy Institute. Give us a little bit of first of all, just introduce yourself to our listeners and give us a little rundown on how you ended up in this world that is very, very exciting and sort of hopefully taking off over the next few years.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I had a really winding path to get here. Maybe 8 years ago, I knew pretty much nothing about psychedelics, and now this literally takes up all of my all of my time, all of my energy, all my focus. And it's been a real labor of love trying to get these studies off the ground here in Toronto, which is so exciting that they're now happening. But so, I'm a clinical psychologist, as you mentioned, and I was doing a postdoctoral fellowship after finishing my PhD, and I was training to become what we call like a trialist, meaning how do you test treatments to see if they work for folks? And I was specifically focusing on both PTSD and on couples. And so my postdoc mentor had developed this treatment called cognitive behavioral conjoint therapy. So it's a couples therapy for PTSD. And we got approached by MAPS, which is the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Research, to suggest perhaps we might want to collaborate together. And MAPS has been doing this work for a really long time, mm-hmm. since 1985, of trying to bring MDMA through as a medicine so that we can use it in the treatment of mental health conditions and then ideally beyond. So at that point, I knew nothing about the use of MDMA in research. And there was a really, I think, a really smart and strategic move that MAPS was doing at the time. They had a study running for therapists to have their own MDMA therapy experience. So, So, imagine going into your like supervisor's office and you get asked like, so do you want to go to South Carolina and take MDMA in a couple of weeks? And you're like,
is there a festival happening? Why are you asking me this?
Yeah. And so I was like, okay. And also, why are we doing this? So I like how I said, okay, first, and then why? No, but,
ask questions later.
Yeah. And so, so I went into that experience kind of with this intellectual question of going like, interesting. I wonder if this could combo with some of these treatments that we're working on to amplify them, make them even more effective, do something else. And so I remember going into that experience myself going like, right, I'm going to take some notes. I'm going to think about this. And then realizing like, as soon as I got there and met with, you know, our my therapist then, but now my colleagues, Annie and Michael Mithofer, like realizing like, oh, no, I have to do my own therapy experience within this. And so kind of let go of the trying to be the good, you know, trialist for a little bit and got to have the experience myself. And so that was the reason why my trajectory shifted into doing this type of work. I found it so compelling,
you know, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. As having done lots of therapy myself as a trainee and then a psychologist. And, you know, think that's really important, you know, if you're sitting in the chair with someone to have had your own experiences in the chair too, then this to me was an incredibly powerful and in-depth tool. And so it catalyzed a lot for me after that. And I was just really taken and interested with it. So that's where it started.
Amazing. Now, before going into this, I'm wondering what were your like preconceived notions of MDMA? You know, like was there any sort of stigmas that you had going into it that, you know, being someone who has never taken MDMA before, you know, I mean psychedelics for decades now have been demonized and viewed as like you know, a net negative thing to be doing in our lives. So was there anything going into it that you were nervous about, or were you pretty, you know, considering this is coming from MAPS and this is coming from like really you know, a very well-established group of folks who really know what they're talking about. Did you kind of go into it feeling pretty okay and open-minded?
Yeah, I would say the fears that I had or the anxieties I had going in were not about the medicine itself. They weren't about the drug. It was more about like, oh, what's it going to bring up in me?
Right.
And so that was more the work and prep I had to do, going like, I have absolutely no idea how this is going, what's going to come up in my psyche. I don't know how it's going to feel in my body. Like those were the major things that were more concerning to me, which actually helps a lot. And now when I'm sitting with people and getting them ready for their experience, is going like, right, I remember how anxious and fearful I was ahead of time because I had no idea. That was the first time where I had done, you know, that type of non-ordinary state work. I think I've had a long meditation practice and a long, you know, history of doing that. So I'm not totally, you know, removed from the concept of different states of consciousness, but not in that way and not in that kind of concentrated focus. So
Isn't it funny how I understand exactly that feeling. You know, whenever I've used like psilocybin, for example, for a purpose, for like a, you know, I want to have like a self-reflective experience, and there's always that piece that you kind of need to it's just a little hump to get over of what's going to come up. And although there's that piece of you that knows that what does come up is probably going to be helpful in the long term of realizing that there's something there that you need to work with and work on, how incredibly uncomfortable that can be, and I think for a lot of people, how it can prevent you from going down that path of reflection or therapy or anything that's going to show you that there's some work to do. How incredibly uncomfortable and fearful that can be.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point there with that, Tate. Like even just the very like vanilla idea of just therapy, you know, just going to see a therapist. There's even those, you know, those butterflies that come up where it's like, oh, I don't know.
Well, yeah. Like, what's going to come up and what am I looking at here? What am I going to have to face? Yeah, I think just like a fairly natural resistance to change that humans have, that change is going to be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, there's inevitably those feelings that you'd like to kind of push away from it. Mm. And I'm curious about MDMA specifically. So, I I have no personal, I have no experience from a therapeutic, from like a clinical use of psychedelics. I have personal recreational experience with psychedelics. And I always thought every time that I had an experience like that, I always kind of thought, wow, the way that this is portrayed in the public is really not jiving with what I'm experiencing. And then it was a few years ago, I read Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind. And then that like really catalyzed thinking about it in a much more broad, holistic use, clinical use for treating conditions and helping the human condition. And I know that he, in that book, he sort of talked about the spectrum of psychedelics and sort of where I remember now MDMA kind of having its own little category, in the spectrum, and that it kind of varied from, things like psilocybin or LSD. Can you kind of give some context to how that might be viewed, MDMA specifically in the range of psychedelics?
Yeah, absolutely. So MDMA is actually not considered like a classic psychedelic. It's had other terms used for it. Some people call it an empathogen, some people an intactogen. Intactogen meaning like to touch within, empathogen meaning to feel connected or empathic with others. And so it has different neurological functioning, different impact on, you know, your neurotransmitters and hormones. I won't really go into that piece, but the idea being that it is, it's not bringing up, for example, hallucinations. You're not going to have visuals with MDMA. You may have things coming up from your psyche that kind of feel like it's maybe some imagery behind your eyes, but that's more from your memory or from your experience. You wouldn't like open your eyes and see something that looks different to you. In that way, it's very different from, say, psilocybin or LSD or a DMT. And so there's that. And also people are very, very present in the here and now when they're on MDMA, but they're also able to go into their memories and be in what we kind of call this optimal zone of arousal, which is why it's so effective for PTSD treatment. So I think with PTSD, people are often either really overactivated or underactivated. And that's why it's so difficult to go back and look at memories, emotions, experiences, because you either shut down or get really, really activated or triggered. And so with MDMA, you have this, the way it's working is that you're in this zone where you can feel, you can actually go and feel the difficult negative things and the positive things without getting over or under activated. And so that is incredibly effective. But you can also think about like, if you're taking it in a different context, like in a recreational context, you're not going to be focusing in that same way. And the MDMA is so malleable in terms of like the effect because it's so context dependent. So depending on where you're taking it and why you're taking it, what the intention is, can be vastly different. And so when people are taking it in the studies, for example, and they're in a room with two therapists and they've got, you know, music playing, eye shades on, they're focused on doing healing work, they're going to have experiences of going inwards and thinking about whatever it is that's coming up for them in those moments, which is really different than being kind of outward focused in a, you know, setting where you might be focusing on other people or music or something.
So it's kind of like, I'm hearing it as sort of like, the bumper, like bumpers at a bowling alley. Like it keeps you in the right lane when you're doing that clinical work where you're working on something like treating PTSD, like keeping you in the right zone to effectively increase
your chances of a strike.
yes, to continue with the bowling analogy.
I think that's a neat descriptor of it. Actually, it's really interesting. In our current studies, someone actually made reference to kind of the bumpers, but they were actually talking about what we do before and after the experience too. So what we call our preparation integration, like the therapy that we're using. And yeah, we're testing a new therapy, or well, a therapy that's been used on its own, but it's a new combination with MDMA. And that, you know, it's more of a protocol-based therapy, meaning it's got things you do each session that you would always do each session. Mm. And so this, you know, participant was talking about it feeling like there are bumpers around the experience, but it's also, it's true. You can kind of think of it as like bumpers in the experience too. Yeah. Even though during it, people are having all kinds of emotional experiences. They're
totally
able to have them.
Yeah. Right.
I really want to get into the, in particular, the two types of therapy, that you guys have, like, you know, investigated. But before we do, just as a refresher, because I know these things kind of change. I mean, not rapidly. Nothing is fast in terms of change in the healthcare system in Canada. But they do change, and with all of the things going on in the world, these changes oftentimes are go unnoticed. And so my question is, what is the current status of the use of psychedelics or psychedelic-esque like drugs in terms of use for therapeutic uses?
Yeah. So in Canada right now, it is illegal to use MDMA, psilocybin, or any other psychedelic. The only one that's kind of a quasi psychedelic that is legal to use is ketamine.
Yes.
And then ketamine is supposed to only be prescribed for very specific indications. We see it being prescribed kind of off label more so. And so, but the data isn't really there, around all the off label prescriptions of ketamine. What I kind of get the sense of is a lot of people are interested in or going towards ketamine assisted therapy because it is the one thing that's legal. It may not be necessarily the top choice for, you know, what it is that people are trying to work on, but it's the only one that people can do. So, I often think about that because it's a dissociative, right? So it takes you kind of up and out of experiences versus when I think about MDMA, it's like getting a hug before you have to go really deeply in and versus, you know, psilocybin or LSD, which are more like you are going down and in, and then you got to go be with it and make your way through. So it's, you can see that eventually, if these things are able to be scheduled so that we can use them in treatment or in, you know, growth, that you're going to have a better pairing of what you want to do versus with what's available. So that means right now, when we're using MDMA or psilocybin here in research, that's approved by Health Canada. So you need approval for that, but it's only for research. And so at the moment, that's what the landscape is.
Oh, wow. Okay. So would that, I feel like I had read, and this might even have been like the catalyst for me reaching out to you back, probably back in December, January, maybe. But I feel like I had read somewhere that like Canada had approved some sort of special access programming. Is that what falls under this notion of research?
So not quite. That's one thing that has shifted a little bit, is there is a special access program for medicines that basically they're for life-threatening illnesses. Okay. And so that program's designed, you can even like, when you look at the forms, that's designed for someone who's, it's immediate, they potentially would die without accessing something else, nothing else is working. And so prior to about December, there was a few cases that were being approved with psilocybin before that. So it was mostly with folks with depression or anxiety related to a terminal illness. Mm-hmm. And so those were being approved. And that was through a bit of a, not a loophole, but it was only psilocybin because it was a mushroom that could be picked. Versus now there has been a shift. There's been an announcement from Health Canada that they're not excluding psychedelics anymore. It used to be that psychedelics were not able to be included, but we're right at the beginning. So we don't know if those cases are going to be approved or not. Like, for example, you can make the argument that someone with, you know, treatment resistant depression has a life-threatening illness because you could have increased suicidality with that. Right. And then, you can make the argument that if, you know, multiple other treatments haven't worked, let's try this because nothing else is working. So you know, we're going to put through a test case with that to the program to see if it'll be approved. But it's very much like a case by case basis. We don't anticipate there's going to be like a huge number of people who are going to be able to go through it. It's really a specific mechanism. But I see it as a good thing that it's even that's even being considered, because that means that
we're on the right track at least.
Right.
Yeah.
This has come up a few times from me in the past couple months. I don't know exactly when this episode is slotted in terms of time, but
soon.
When I hear you talk about how, you know, you can get pushed towards like a ketamine treatment because it's sort of like what's available instead of really what's really going to do the best work depending on what you're trying to treat and what you're dealing with. And this is a bit of a different conversation, but I think that it leads itself to this in terms of the way that things can be, you know, very challenging to get things off the ground, to get trials going, to get things approved. And it's a conversation that I heard with a psychopharmacologist. His name is David Nutt. He's in the UK, and he authored the paper that we've talked about several times on the show, which is the study between psilocybin and versus, I can't remember the name of the drug, but it was a common antidepressant, and sort of how the two stacked up against each other. Yeah. And David Nutt did this podcast that I listened to with a guy named Peter Attia. And he has this framework for how different drugs have been, what their effect is to the individual, and then what that effect is on society as well, mm-hmm. versus how we have scheduled them in terms of the way that we've legislated these drugs and where they fall in terms of how they're scheduled and all that stuff, and how those two things, how it affects the individual in society and how we've legislated them, are so divorced from each other, mm-hmm. That you end up with this mishmash of different substances that are categorized in wildly ineffective ways, which then ultimately makes, you know, work like what you're doing and work with compounds that have really amazing benefits, incredibly challenging based on just a historical misunderstanding of what these drugs are and what they do. And I mean, I know that we're moving in the right direction right now, but I can't help but find it frustrating looking back in time and going, there's so many mistakes made that if they weren't made, then, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people are getting relief from their conditions or from the things that they're struggling with way, way sooner, or maybe mitigated almost entirely, you know, if we had just been, you know, smarter and more rational with the way that we looked at these certain compounds. Sorry, that ended up being a bit of a rant.
I mean, yeah, you're telling me the frustration with that, like the number of like hurdles it takes to do this type of work. And, you know, it took us 3 years to get our first study in Toronto off the ground. And that was already, I'd already done a study in the States. but it was, you know, to try to get it set up and ready to roll here. And thankfully we're there. And I have to say, actually, Health Canada has been really good to work with. It's more, it's getting the ethics approval. Like, you know, the boards they're scared, which it makes sense. It's new, it's different. And there has been such stigma around these substances. Right. But it's, you know, it's the safety profiles are so much safer than a lot of medications that are out there. And so you go like, wow, like all of these hoops to jump because of the stigma that's there. And you hope you're just going to be held to the same medical and scientific standard that other things are, but you know that you're going to be scrutinized. Like, and so I think that's the thing now, is we're at a time where it's like in the public consciousness. The fact that we're having this conversation speaks to that, or people are interested, they're compelled by it. And it's like, we have to do it right, because otherwise we may lose the opportunity to actually continue with this work if people kind of go rogue or aren't careful and don't cross their T's and dot their I's. So I'm always mindful of that, even though obviously I would love it to go a little faster. It would be, you know, I don't mind doing the mountains of paperwork around it, because I, you know, feel like that's what will create the, what we need so that it can continue. Right.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Let's actually talk about some of the trials and some of the research. I know that you were the lead investigator of a pilot trial using cognitive processing therapy, CPT, for PTSD using MDMA. I guess my first question there is, what is typically without MDMA, what is CPT? How does CPT typically work?
Yeah, so CPT is a talk therapy. So it's usually about 12 sessions, and people would usually do it weekly. So think of standard psychotherapy. You go in, you talk with your therapist for an hour. And the focus of that treatment is on meaning making around traumatic events. And so the way that we're working with thoughts and emotions to understand where the person is stuck after the trauma. And so you're looking at how their beliefs may have become more entrenched if they weren't helpful to begin with, or they may have shifted and are keeping the person in a place where, for example, like acceptance and blame and power and control and intimacy, those are all impacted by the trauma. So you're kind of untangling that knot with folks in the talk therapy. And so when we're combining it with MDMA, what we're trying to do is amplify the parts of the therapy where we think it could use a boost. And so we do two MDMA sessions. We do one early on in the protocol to get folks going, kind of get them, you know, deep in, like, so they have a couple of therapy sessions beforehand so that they're getting comfortable with the therapist. They're thinking about their trauma. They're talking about it. And then we go in for the first session. Then they're doing processing between. Then the second session is really in the heart of the trauma processing. And so they have another session there that helps that process kind of unstick even more. So yeah, that's what we're doing.
And with this trial, going into this beforehand, I'm sure you had some ideas of like what to maybe perhaps expect, especially being someone who actually has put yourself in the shoes of the patient of, you know, going through this. What stuck out to you in that first trial? Did anything surprise you in terms of results or things that you really weren't quite anticipating?
Yeah. So it's interesting the way we've done it. So the very first pilot we ran was a couples pilot, and then we're actually running the CPT one right now. So it's hot off the presses, which is great in terms of what's happening. And very close in my mind, you know, because we just had a session last week and, you know, we have another one on Saturday. So it's in the ongoing process. But what's really been cool is taking the learnings from the first one, which was like the first time I'd ever sat with anyone in an MDMA session after having had my own experiences, but then getting to witness everyone's different experiences. And that's one thing that really struck me is how vastly different everybody's unique experience is in the MDMA session. So I was able to appreciate that, given that I knew what mine felt like. And then seeing that, you know, this person's is really different from this person's. And in that couple study too, we were dosing two people together. So one person with PTSD and then their partner. And those, you know, when you see two people in the session at the same time who are having vastly different experiences too, that it's, I like it because it keeps you on your toes, first of all, but also I don't make assumptions or guesses in terms of how it's going to go in the session because
you kind of answered the question that was coming up into my head there, but I just wanted to make sure that when you're doing couples therapy using MDMA,
and for PTSD, it is often, I guess, the somebody who's dealing with PTSD, or maybe both, but I'm assuming more commonly it's probably one, and is it couples therapy because the way that trauma is affecting the relationship?
Great question. Yeah. So, that intervention is, so maybe I'll dial back and like share a bit about that one, and then that'll help answer that question. So that's the treatment that we originally invited to collaborate with MAPS on. And so that's a couples treatment where normally it's 15 sessions, and we condensed it down into, we did everything in about, 6 weeks with that one. And again, 2 MDMA sessions. And the purpose there and why they're doing it together is that we think that healing from PTSD in a relationship or in a system can have broader impact than just doing it on your own. So I think both ways are effective. And a lot of people don't have someone they would want to do a treatment with, but if they do, then having that opportunity. So you can not only target PTSD, but you can target the relationship's functioning and outcomes for the partner too. So for that study, we ran that one in South Carolina with our colleagues at their clinic, and it was 6 couples. And in that case, it happened to be all romantic couples. Even though we were open to it being, it could have been siblings, it could have been parent child, could have been really close friends. It happened to be that we ended up recruiting 6 romantic couples. And it was the case that we had one person had to have PTSD and the other one didn't have PTSD. In the future, I don't know that that would necessarily have to be the case. It was just, you know, you have to be pretty clear, like parameters in a trial. So, you know, we're running this individual one in Toronto, and then we're about to launch a large couples one. So kind of the larger trial of that original one. So we'll be doing that here too.
How large is large?
60 couples.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Yeah. That is large. Yeah. Wow. Amazing.
Yeah. Huge. So it's going to be, big piece of work over about 5 years. And that one will be romantic or beyond. So,
it's not necessarily or specifically to target the way in which, someone's trauma might be affecting the relationship that they're in, be it sibling or something, but it's actually the combination of having a person with someone that they care about dealing with the trauma to sort of like together in support and having that experience together.
Yeah. And I think it's actually both, right? So it is how it's impacting them together, and it's focusing on how it is in the relationship. So there's, you know, we talk about how each of them are impacted, how the relationship is impacted, how the relationship might be keeping it alive in some ways. We talk about that as like accommodation, which can be really well-meaning, but unfortunately it ends up creating the circumstance where, you know, people stay stuck, and that can be a huge piece of trying to unravel that, because both people are bought in to that, oh no, I can never, or, I take care of all these things for my partner because, you know, otherwise, you know, they'll get too activated or they can't handle that. I have to keep everything quiet.
That's one of the wilder things about PTSD, you know, like how it doesn't just manifest for the person who's diagnosed with it, but it really finds ways to manifest even within the people that are close to that person. And it makes a whole lot of sense that this study is happening, because I feel like it could be, you know, pretty revolutionary. In terms of this large one that you have coming up, like what are the parameters? What are the things that you are looking for like ideal candidates?
Yeah. So we're still at the stage in MDMA research where we're very careful in terms of folks, kind of medical comorbidities. So basically people have to be physically healthy to go in. So we do a huge medical screen. We also are doing things like other psychological screen as well. So I think that's important. So people, you know, we have some things where people can't have a different disorder, but not every disorder. So it's, generally speaking, what we're looking for is 2 people who want to go through the treatment together and who the strength of their relationship is there, and they don't have to be happy in the relationship. They could be distressed, but they have to be committed to doing the work together, and it has to be impacting both of them. And I think that's important. So for example, you know, people who live on other sides of the country, that's probably not going to be impacting their day-to-day in the same way together versus folks who are, you know, cohabitating in some way, shape or form.
And what is the dosage for something like that? Is that something you can talk about? Like what, like how the, like the technicalities of like what is dosed out for these sessions?
Yeah. So, the dosages have varied a little bit between studies. So for the first study we did, for example, the first session, there's two MDMA sessions. The first one, people get 75 milligrams. So it's kind of like the lowest therapeutic dose.
Yeah.
And then, they got 100 milligrams in the second one.
Okay.
The future one we're planning would be 100 milligrams across the board for folks. And, you know, studies have gone up to like 120, 125. And those are all in the kind of therapeutic range.
Yeah, cool. I'm wondering about, the, you know, when the, you know, you were saying that they're like 1 hour sessions, when looking at things like CBT and CPT. Mm-hmm. And I know that, I've heard, that, when people, ingest MDMA, that it is an experience that lasts, you know, 6 to 8 hours.
So I've heard,
word on the street. I'm wondering, like, how do you account for that extended period of, what was the word? Non-ordinary state, that, you know, is that one session when you use the medicine kind of dragged out a little longer, or do you just keep it to the 1 hour and then have sort of like an aftercare booklet that you just give to the patient?
Yeah, definitely not. No. So when we do our MDMA days, we are with the participant for 8 hours. The therapists are there. We're actually in the room where I'm sitting right now, and they're on my couch back there. Yeah, so we're there with them all day. So our the way we're actually doing it in these studies is we're condensing down like what would normally be, for example, 12 sessions in CPT. We're doing it in six. So we get these 2 hour chunks of therapy and then these two long MDMA days. So that allows, you know, whatever is going to happen, whatever's going to unfold in that experience, there's a lot of space and time for that to happen, and the person's supported throughout it, which is really important. And I think that's when you think about the context of how people are doing this work, being well supported in those sessions is incredibly important, so people can feel safe to actually do that deep internal work. You can feel the difference too, even between the first one and the second one. Like, people are more connected, they're more able to accept support in a heartfelt way, you know. And it's interesting because we, you know, as a therapist, I am of one of the schools where I don't touch my clients. Like, I, you know, would barely like shake a hand or hug, which is funny. As a person, I do, but as a therapist, I don't. I like to keep that space. But in the MDMA sessions, when we talk about this beforehand, we do offer some therapeutic touch, meaning like a hand to hold or a hand on the shoulder and the forehead. And it can be incredibly effective. And you can imagine, like, you can see the difference if the person wasn't there and they weren't offering that, how the person could go more deeply in. And, you know, it's happened for many participants we've worked with. I actually do think most that at some point they want some type of like a hand. And it's usually when they're going into something really difficult and it's, you know, they're able to have that human connection.
On the PTSD side of things in the context of how we see it and how we understand it societally, and you know, and maybe this was I'm making the assumption that this was probably frustrating from the seat of the psychologist as PTSD became so known in pop culture as like a war related thing, how it sort of came into the public consciousness as like, you know, this is the thing that that people experience when they go to war, and how, and I don't really think that's where it is now. I think by and large it's exited that phase, and it's more understood as you know, basically anything traumatic can lead to that. At least that's my perception, but I'm in a bit of a bubble with this podcast, so I could be wrong. But what are your sort of thoughts on where that is in terms of how, you know, people who experience PTSD, I feel like if the understanding of it is more general and broad for what it actually is or how it can actually manifest, mm-hmm. can lead to more people seeking therapy for relief. I've kind of lost my train of thought in terms of how I was forming this question, but societally, do you feel that has come along?
I do. And in fact, I think it's shifted a lot. And even to the case where I think folks are starting to recognize the impact of traumatic experiences. And what's interesting is that folks will often equate having had a traumatic experience with PTSD, that they're kind of one and the same, when it's actually the case that a traumatic experience and struggling afterwards can cause a whole range of different things. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because in some ways it's almost like PTSD kind of gets privileged within that like, that's the like, oh, you're actually suffering if you have PTSD. But I mean, really, like, some people could develop depression. Some people could have a substance use, disorder. Some people could have an eating disorder. Like, there's all kinds of things that can happen. PTSD is just one outcome. And that folks are, I really believe, like, on a spectrum all the time on all of these different things. You just, if you hit kind of a threshold, then you might get a diagnosis of one of these conditions.
Right. Yeah.
But we can all be somewhere along the line on everything at some point in time. So I definitely think the public understanding around the impact of trauma, the impact of PTSD has changed drastically, even like within the length of time that I've been doing this work, which is great. But I also think that it's like, we almost like we need to further the conversation even more around it, going like, right, it's not just PTSD and it's not just complex PTSD. It's like, there's these other things that can come out of it too. And it doesn't make the trauma any less bad. It just is a different.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, especially now, you know, like, especially considering the last 2 years has been a rather traumatic event for pretty much every single human on the planet. Yeah. You know, in the next decade, I think it's going to be really important that we acknowledge the nuances of what a traumatic event actually can result in. You know,
I also want to point out that I've noticed, and I think you could probably attest to this, Jer, just in you know, general conversation with people, that you start to find that the term PTSD has started to be used sort of in the same way that people will use OCD to describe being really neat. Mm-hmm. Like how they'll say that, you know, some experience that wasn't traumatic, but maybe it sucked, but it probably wouldn't fall under the category of traumatic, is, you know, has given them PTSD, and it uses like a throwaway term, which equally has its issues. And not that's people who are using it that way are, you know, ill meaning or anything, but that you want to be careful about how language sort of starts to lose its power, because it is a very meaningful and challenging thing. And so you want to kind of treat it with the respect that I guess it deserves.
One of the things that I feel is kind of sort of important to note here, just through the discussion that we've had, and maybe Anne, you can kind of add to this with what you have with your knowledge, but just this notion of like how how psychedelics and psychedelics being used for healing and being used for growth. You know, both Taylor and I just have said openly on the podcast 1,000 times that although we've never done it in a space with a trained professional to guide us through that, we have like recreationally dabbled in the world of psychedelics with a like deep intention. But I think it's, you know, for people hearing these types of conversations, I think one of the things that is really important to realize and just consider is how psychedelics are, and this is your own words, and psychedelics are opening the door for the opportunity to heal. Mm-hmm. But the psychedelic itself doesn't do the healing.
Right.
And yeah, so just, you know, to that point, like, is there anything that you can add to that just for people listening to this right now thinking like, oh wow, this sounds great. I'm going to go and buy some Molly and try to do the work on my own.
Yeah. Oh yeah. This is like my favorite topic it very much is the case where a psychedelic can create the opportunity or the pathway that someone can have a really powerful opening or healing or whatnot. However, it is not just taking it. It is like, it's then like, what do you do with the insights that come up? What happens afterwards? Oftentimes it's really difficult after one of these psychedelic experiences because you're cracked open. You suddenly see all these things that are coming up, you like old memory or realizing of patterns or habits, or it's illuminating everything. It's showing you what's there. And actually we use that, you know, verbiage a lot that, for example, with MDMA, it's going to show you whatever needs to come up in that moment. And that might not be very pretty. Right. Mm. And so if that's coming up, then it's like, great. You've been just get handed this gift, this opportunity of going, great. Okay. See it. Now what? Now what do I do with it? And so that's the important part. And that's why it's really interesting too. For example, like when folks are deeply into the psychedelic world and, you know, journeying very frequently, I'm, you know, often it's the question mark of like, but why? Because if you're doing this and then needing to take time to integrate what's happened, it's very difficult to be doing, you know, journeys all the time, because it's like, where's the learning coming from after that? So, I often think about that. And it's happening a little bit less now. I think there's been more clarity in the messaging that's happening in the media, and there's less like magic bullet effect. But people do still have that idea that this is going to be the cure. But a lot of folks, when they were contacting the clinic and also not realizing, you know, at Remedy that we don't offer, you know, we don't sit for people in our normal clinic. Like we do prep and integration if people have experiences outside the clinic, but people weren't understanding. They're like, oh, you can't just give me MDMA and
let me be on my way.
And yeah, I'm like, no, that's really, really not it. And it's like, that's only like one piece of the puzzle. It's within the whole, you know, larger.
And of course, that's the way that is the way that we typically relate to medicine, right? It's like, take the pill and the pill makes you better, you know? Yeah. But this is not that. This is a very different, thing. This is a tool to put into play the work that needs to be done. It's not like taking an Advil to get rid of, you know, an ache or a pain.
That is a fascinating insight there, Jer. Like I've never really thought about it that way, but our relationship to taking really anything is that it will just do it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
And that's the default expectation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to say, first of all, congratulations, Anne, because I know that the Remedy Institute just got its charitable status, which that's very exciting. Tell us, you know, before we wrap, just give us a little bit of insight into the Remedy Institute, you know, how it works, and how, I mean, I don't know if this is one, if this is a thing or not, but like, can people get involved in terms of helping this sort of research go further and, you know, allow ourselves to get a little bit closer to that point where we're trying to get, which is a place where these medicines can be used widely.
Absolutely. And so that's the one of the pillars of Remedy Institute is the idea of forming community and doing things in community around it. So the idea with Remedy Institute and having it as a charity has always been in the vision with Remedy. And so they're always meant to exist side by side. So Remedy, the clinic, it donates its profits to Remedy Institute. And so Remedy Institute is now the home for the research. So we run our clinical trials there. And we also have a fund for accessible services. Mm. And so meaning that people can donate money for other folks to access mental health services, because that's one of the biggest issues we have in terms of getting people to wellness is people can't afford it. And so that's one of our ways that we're trying to help in that way. And so, yeah, with the Institute, what we're doing, we have a current trial that's running, which is CPT plus MDMA. We have the big upcoming couples trial. And then we have a number of other ones in the works, including, you know, hopefully in a little bit down the line, and we're going to fundraise for this, is doing a couples therapy with MDMA with no diagnosis. So for relationship functioning. So that's a big one on the horizon. And we have a number of other projects that our team members are engaged in and working on. So yeah, we officially launched today, actually, the day of recording this in the Institute. Wow. Yeah. Cool. And if people are interested, they can either join our mailing list, and which is at remedyinstitute.ca, and they can stay up to date on events. And now that they, you know, we're hopefully able to gather together a little bit more, we'll be having and a more community building events where people can learn about the work and actually see where it's taking place. Mm. And people can also donate, so they can do that through the page.
Amazing.
Awesome.
Dr. Ann Wagner, this has been exactly what I anticipated to be a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for taking us into your world and showing us just a little bit of what you've got coming up. It's endlessly fascinating, and I'm so optimistic and hopeful for a future where these medicines are getting into the hands of the people that need them and used in a really responsible and you know, helpful way. Thank you for the work that you do. Thank you for taking time out of your schedule to sit down and chat with us. This has been a real treat.
Well, thanks so much. This has been a real pleasure. I'm really glad to have the conversation.
That is it for today. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in.
If you like what you heard, make sure that you share our podcast with your friends. We love those extra ears.
Sick Boy Podcast is a Snack Labs production. It is produced by myself, Jeremy Saunders, Taylor McGilvery, Brian Stever, and Lauren Sankey. Sound design is coming to you from Donovan the Meerkat Morgan. The music of the show is from our friend Rich O'Coin. And Sick Boy Podcast is managed by Jeffrey Lonis. That is it for today.
I'm Brian.
I'm Taylor.
And I'm Jeremy. And this is Sick Boy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.